Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Kerry Curtis, a member of the club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience on the radio, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. James, or Jamie, Workman is a graduate of Yale and Oxford and began his award-winning career as a journalist writing for The New Republic, Washington Monthly, The Utney Reader, Orion, and other publications. In the Clinton administration, he served as speechwriter and special assistant to Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt, who has spoken here at the Commonwealth Club recently, spearheading a national campaign that demolished obsolete dams to replenish dying rivers. For 7 years in Africa and Asia, he helped to forge the landmark report of the World Commission on Dams, filed overseas dispatches on water scarcity, led documentary research safaris, lectured at universities, and advised global businesses, aid agencies, and conservation organizations on water policy. Based on his experience with the Kalahari Bushmen, he is pioneering new platforms for trading the human right to water. He lives with his wife and two daughters in San Francisco, and it's now my privilege to welcome James Workman.
Thank you, Kerry. It may seem quite a stretch to say that Africa has something to teach us here. After all, we all know the horror stories, the AIDS, the overpopulation, the corrupt politicians and homeless and wasted opportunities. If you watch the news, it gets pretty discouraging. But when you live in a place for a few years, as I have, it starts to get under your skin. And you come to love the stark beauty of the place and the resilience of its people. And so I refuse to give up on that hot, harsh, unstable region that was first colonized by Europeans in the 19th century as a strategic outpost, a land where warlike tribes of herders and farmers descended on hunter-gatherers and forced them into places of alcoholism, boredom, despair, and disease, a place which set aside nature reserves as playgrounds for the rich and denied the rights of poor indigenous families who had always lived there, a backward economy that became a powerhouse by mining precious minerals while sacrificing priceless water, a fragile, messy, ungovernable democracy that must now cope with vanishing resources in a hot, dry climate. I refer, of course, to California. California remains a place of social innovation and great technology, and I think its most creative years lie ahead of it, but only if, like an extraordinary group of Africans, it can overcome its Achilles heel, which is an acute lack of water. Right now we're in the midst of a 3-year dry spell, something that scientists say will soon become the norm, if it hasn't already. Just this April, studies commissioned by the governor found that for the coming century, Californians are going to have to get used to coping with less water, faster evaporations, worse wildfires, more intense heat waves, and longer droughts. The troubling thing is, even if we stopped all carbon emissions, as they're talking about trying to do in Copenhagen, reduce them, even if we did that, the heat will keep rising. And the Sierra snowpack that we depend on, that vast, reliable natural reservoir, will keep melting away. Millions of residents on bigger lawns will keep fighting for a shrinking supply. And to make matters worse, even a slight rise in sea level, whether it's a matter of inches or feet, can affect the delta pumps, shutting them down instead of having them pump salt water throughout the state. The panacea, a lot of people, especially in Silicon Valley, say, well, you know, there's desalination plants. And the trouble with this quick fix is that it requires prodigious amounts of energy. From already, energy is requiring 49% of the water in the state. And it also produces more emissions both in the air and in the water, killing a lot of the life in the process of trying to preserve our water. So yeah, the situation looks bleak. But the story of how I found some hope and inspiration and ideas and innovation in the Bushmen of all people, in the middle of the Kalahari, it begins with a single word, and that word is Monopoly. Who here has played Monopoly? Yes. Okay. It's a fascinating game, isn't it? It was born, actually, I've looked this up, during the Depression, and it taught generations of Americans the virtue of self-interest. You know, Adam Smith's invisible hand moved our metal pieces, our dogs and top hats and cars around these beautiful, colorful real estate, making a new Donald Trumps out of us with every roll of the dice. And even if you got a D in economics, as I did, you could put red hotels on Boardwalk and Park Place and drive your friends and family into bankruptcy. Now, in real life, of course, Monopoly conjures up names for every commodity we know. People Teddy Roosevelt called malefactors of great wealth, people that Ayn Rand lionized as the heroes and saviors of America, people like Cecil Rhodes, the De Beers diamond cartel, Andrew Carnegie, the steel magnate, J.D. Rockefeller of Standard Oil, J.P. Morgan, who set the example for today's Wall Street entrepreneurs. In this century, the antitrust lawyers don't go after individuals so much as brand name monopolies, IBM, AT&T, Microsoft, and our own local mom-and-pop store in the backyard of Silicon Valley, Google. Few of these monopolies endure, though. And by now, most have either been broken up or faded away. The truth is, we can walk away from most of these monopolies. We can walk away from oil and steel and diamonds and phones, and at least in theory, we can walk away from Google. So, outside of the game monopoly, is there really any such thing as a long-lasting, people-enslaving, all-powerful monopoly? I think there is. The insidious thing about this monopoly is that few of us even know it exists, even as it manipulates us. It's a monopoly that's quiet and faceless. No brand name, no celebrity CEO, yet it controls every meaningful aspect of our existence. How we live, where we live, and in some parts of the world, if we live. If we're aware of it or not, we're beholden to this monopoly for our health and energy and food and income. Now you may say, oh, just like The Matrix, the movie with Keanu Reeves, but that's science fiction. The truth is that 72% of our bodies are enmeshed in a very real matrix, which is controlled by a handful of well-meaning strangers. This is Al at the local plant. Operating a quiet, bland, monolithic entity. And it's that boring square that no one wanted when we played Monopoly. Remember Waterworks. And I think most, if not all, of our problems can be traced to this water monopoly, at least on three levels. The federal monopoly that determines which water states are allowed, from Georgia, Florida, Alabama, California, Arizona, Colorado. Within the state of California, a monopoly decides how much water its cities and rural areas get. And of course, our local monopoly, our utility, controls the water you and I use, what it tastes like, what we charge, what we pay for it. And this is the part where we just grow up with this and we take it for granted until, as I was talking to somebody earlier, they said, the quality is just bad. You can't negotiate that. Or somebody says, I think we're paying too much for our water. You can't negotiate with that either. That's the nature of a monopoly. Now, all these entities are called natural monopolies because it would be impossible to have two or more competing dams, rivers, pipes, water towers, sewer systems competing with one another. So that's fair. And these worked long enough and well enough when there was plenty of water to go around for everyone. That's not the case anymore. And the trouble is that monopolies now undermine California's attempts at conservation and efficiency. Why? Because they eliminate choice. They eliminate our opportunity to make free decisions. We talked about, LA is stealing our water. They're wasting our water. In fact, Los Angeles has these restrictions right now, ordinances that are kind of creepy to me anyways. I call them the sort of Ten Commandments of water. And I swear I'm not making these up, that it is now illegal to hose your sidewalk, to sprinkle your yard, your lawn on days that aren't Monday or Thursday. All these different things. You can't go into a restaurant. If the waiter brings you a glass of water without your asking for it, he's breaking the law now. And this is one kind of say, well, this is how monopolies have to conserve water. The other thing is, well, let's call for voluntary conservation. We say, oh, there might be rationing coming up, so let's all do our bit and conserve. This, of course, has the opposite effect because people say, honey, if they're going to ration us, let's double our use so that they ration us down to what we're using right now. Those who do scale back, who's like my dad's here, he's just like, I'm going to take shorter showers, I'm going to water the lawn better or the garden. They're punished because the less water you use, the utility makes up for it by charging you more. So this leads economists to say, well, the situation's obvious. All you need to do, beyond rationing, forget that, is raise prices. And it's a very easy thing to say if you're not the one who's doing the price raising. It's a very sensitive issue, again, because you can't negotiate. And so that's often a doomed choice in a monopoly when there's no choices. Raising prices, it's political suicide. You never hear a politician stand up and say, vote for me, and I will quadruple your water bills. The result, whenever they've tried to do that through privatization here in California or elsewhere, creates this huge backlash. People start protesting, oh, you're making profits off of my water. And this leads to a kind of situation that we're facing not just in California, but all over the world. Whereas most catastrophes, climate or otherwise, bring people together to sort of build a wall against water or to put out a fire, water scarcity drives us apart. It turns you against your neighbor. It turns your neighborhood against upstream users. It turns the city against farmers and the farmers against neighboring states and neighboring states against Mexico. And this is the insidious aspect. When you talk to some water managers, people in California who've been doing that for years, he was reported as saying, well, what's going to happen in 15 years? He says, I don't know. It looks like an Armageddon. And that's frightening. And that's what led me to sort of say that this is a sinister side of our water monopoly. And how can we find some place on Earth that's free from monopoly, that would untap the extraordinary potential that could come through unlocking monopoly? And it came through a journey to basically to the ends of the earth. Found if California doesn't have a way out, who does? And I want to take you there, basically back along our evolutionary lines, a journey of man, as one author called it, tracing us back to the oldest, richest DNA on Earth, the closest thing we have to a genetic Adam and Eve, an extraordinary people called the Bushmen. And then in the austral summer of 2002, to force Bushmen to relocate out of their home in the Kalahari, the government of Botswana abruptly cut off its deliveries of fresh water. It destroyed their water pumps and their storage. This began the story in the book, but I came to it pretty slowly. I arrived there in Botswana as a young man in a hurry. I had been, as Carrie said, a journalist and then a speechwriter for Bruce Babbitt. And then the United States just weren't big enough for me. I had grand ambitions. I had to work someplace that had the word world in the title, the World Commission on Dams, the World Water Council, the World Conservation Union. And I was feeling pretty proud of myself. It was very heady stuff when I arrived there. And it all came unglued in a humiliating ordeal, which I really shouldn't go into. Okay, I will. I was driving my shiny new red 8-cylinder Land Rover Defender, and I met in Botswana some human rights activists who overcame my fear and persuaded me to pose as a tourist and sneak provisions into bands of Bushmen who had decided to stay put in the middle of the Kalahari. I set out for this place called Metsia Manong, which translates as vulture water. I was feeling pretty self-righteous. It's an extraordinary place, the Kalahari. You can't really prepare yourself for it. The four-lane paved highway turns to about 1.5 lanes and then turns into this horrible, thick, dry sand. Fifth gear cruising along turns into a 1 or 2 gear grinding. But after evening, I'd entered a different world. At dusk, I passed huge, beautiful black-maned lions on the prowl. But again, I was resisting photographs because I was in a hurry to save these defiant last of the first, these bushmen, celebrated in the Gods Must Be Crazy. And again, as you can see here, the next day during my one-man water-smuggling operation, I broke down in the middle of nowhere, and the engine had sucked in sand and got clogged in the carburetors. I lacked the experience and the tools to open it up and clean it out. And after my screams sort of tapered off, the insect noises of the Kalahari started to rise and in the silence. And at that point, gasoline became far less important than the water I had along with me. Paraphrase Samuel Johnson, when a man in a desert knows he will run out of water in a fortnight, it concentrates the mind wonderfully. As I grew accustomed to the Kalahari, I realized the network of life out there, and there was an awful lot of life for thousands and thousands of years where humans and wildlife co-evolved with one another. Plants, birds, mammals, humans, they all thrived in this vibrant, fiercely competitive economy of water. Their dynamic exchanges reminded me that in the interwoven tapestry of life, it wasn't so much a food cycle that we're always taught in grade school, but a water cycle. And through it all, in the Kalahari, no single organism could dominate another. This drove home the lesson that nature abhors a monopoly. In the absence of that monopoly, Bushmen had to develop over time an extraordinary coping mechanism, a code of conduct that kept them together and let them endure. And by the next day, when I chased down in the middle of the night some tourists heading off in a different direction, and they helped unclog the engine and get me going again, I'd undergone basically a spiritual conversion on the road to Damascus, in this case on the road to Vulture Water. I realized the only true water management experts, you often hear about, water management experts, they aren't the engineers that supply, it's the users. It's everyone in this room that has to adapt their demand. And in this, I started to realize as I came to know them, Bushmen weren't superhuman. They grew just as irritable and suspicious as you or I. They felt jealousy and hunger pangs and thirst just like all of us. They generated conflict over scarcity. They weren't just immediately noble. But somehow through all this, they managed to channel their emotions and self-interest into a self-regulating interdependence. It softened their tension into laughter, and they transformed water, however scarce, into their cohesive social glue. So over the next 5 years, and even till today, going in and out of the Kalahari and poring over every study and book I could get my hands on, I tried hard to grasp how they survived, how they thrived. And to me, their approach basically boils down to what I call the seven habits of highly resilient people. The Bushmen turn scarcity into relative abundance as they seek shelter. Their only enemy isn't other people out there. It's the sun. They compare the sun as a death force, like the hyena. And where you and I see a great reservoir, an important dam, they see a stupid sacrifice to the gods. They trap and secure water in closed, concealed, evaporation-proof storage containers, systems, a strategy that we in California are only starting to adapt with groundwater recharge and closed reservoir systems. Again, they'd move from ostrich eggshells to plastic canteens to metal oil drums, but it was all sheltering that water from the sun. Another thing they did was they consumed local. We often hear about locavores, but as Bushmen eat and drink close to the source, they do so to avoid the leaks, the energy expenditure, the spills and pollution and exposure and transport. And I think we're starting again to catch on to this and saying we can save time and labor and resources and avoid loss by minimizing the distances conveying our freshwater resources, thinking closer to the mouth and the land as they have. Next thing they did is they diversified supply. Bushmen get about 80% of their water embedded in the food, embedded in the land. So they capture the rest from under rocks and dispersed pockets in the natural infrastructure, as we call it. Rather than depend on one single dam or one single water tower, which may fail or dry up, They spread risk. They disperse that risk all around and boost their resilience through existing technology that taps groundwater and fog and dew and reuse and runoff. These are Sama melons, which are the equivalent of their water towers, which they would gather at the certain time of year when they would ripen and be filled with water. The next thing they do is they devolve decisions. When an elephant threatened their water supply, they didn't just send one person off. They talked about it. They figured out, okay, what are we going to do? And this is an interesting thing because Bushmen self-govern, but they don't elect or submit to a coercive authority as we do. By spreading responsibility laterally, trust emerges through constant voluntary interaction with one another. And facing these finite supplies, we too could build resilience through incentives that empower and reward those who do more with less, as the Bushmen have. Getting a little bit more controversial, the Bushmen own shares in water. And this came as a surprise to me. While you and I hold maybe deeds or title or even, you know, to a car or to our furniture or even our house, we cannot own the water flowing through our pipes that keep us alive. Bushmen can, and they do. They respect informal title to water resources. There's something when we care for that which we own and we entrust people with equal water credits, that can change things. How many people here own a car? How many of you have ever rented a car? Which one do you take better care of? Which do you change the oil, the windshield wiper fluid, inflate the tires properly? And this is the same message, the same concept we're trying to get at, and I understood from the Bushmen that that's why they take care of it. They think about how to make that share go as far as possible. They also encourage exchanges. Bushmen were never the proto-Marxists that I once thought they were, of just sort of sharing out of the goodness of their heart, practicing ancient communism. They truck, barter, and exchange water resource credits, invisible credits that they keep track of with each other, within a transparent network. I think we can do that too. Through sip wells for them, through hunting, through all the water embedded in the resources that they hunted and gathered, the innovative and the frugal individuals who reduced their demands had more to bring to the table for everyone else, expanding resilience and efficiency for everyone. And this brings us back to the final thing, the unlocked monopolies. When the government cut off their water, it in some cases did them a favor, because you cannot be free as long as you depend on the one entity for all water, without which you die. When we loosen the rigid forces of monopoly, we can negotiate the terms by which we choose to live. And that choice isn't easy. It's very tempting to me and everyone, I'm sure, to depend on monopolies to take care of our water. But as a Bushmen matriarch, a protagonist of the book, her name is Toraklu Dutri, and we'll all practice that name later. As she put it, when I was young, the men hunted, and we got our water from the roots of plants. We lived well, and people only died of old age, not diseases. But then the government officials started bringing us water. And now that I think about it, I believe it was to make us dependent and abandon our traditional ways and get us to move. Like Bushmen, California must learn to adapt to the rule of water. How do we do so? Well, we can adapt to water scarcity not by abandoning all the things we've come to love, eBay or Amazon, Sky Miles or Facebook. To the contrary, exactly those Web 2.0 technologies can help us unlock incentives and track use and earn trust and accrue credit with one another, enable exchanges and break up the water trust by creating virtual click markets within brick-and-mortar water monopolies. We can keep the physical infrastructure, the natural monopoly that we all turn on our pipes and hoses, but at the same time we can own an equal share, as the Bushmen do, of that water to use as we please. If we use that share up, we own nothing. If we use a little bit more, we pay dearly for it. But if we use less, We can save and donate or exchange our savings with others, rewarding efficiency and triggering a collective race to conserve. And that's, again, all very nice, but what can we do about it out here? I was slow to absorb all this. During the second of my journeys into the Kalahari, I moved with tape recorder and camera from one bushman to the next until coming to that matriarch, Oraklu, and hoping to extract important answers to big questions like, so what will you do without government water? When I asked, she kept scooping with Sama melon out for food, trading gossip with another woman next to her. I said, how are you going to manage water during the drought? The old woman shrugged without looking up, shifted back on her heels, and a little fire was going next to her. It was mostly smoke, but it never went out. I kept persisting. I said, do you think you can manage enough water for your family and your band to last through the rainy season? And like others before her, she grew evasive. Repeating the question through my translator again met with silence. And at that time, her caginess didn't make sense. Only years later, it has begun to. It wasn't that Bushmen didn't want to answer such questions. They just couldn't. My grilling a Bushman about how humans must manage water was like a Vatican cleric interrogating Galileo about how the sun must orbit the earth. The Bushman code of conduct may help us in the outside world escape a Hobbesian or Neo-Malthusian nightmare. Prepared for extreme deprivation, Kalahari Bushmen chose a hard but free responsibility of a dry reality over a government-dependent fantasy of a monopoly of excess water that bred a false sense of abundance. I began my talk a few minutes ago by borrowing some rhetoric from Robert Kennedy when he was in Cape Town. And I want to close by paraphrasing his older brother. Because our challenge is whether we can set aside some of our technological and wealth and arrogance and recognize the true greatness through humility. And so I think we need to ask not what California can do for Africa's indigenous people, but instead ask what the lessons of those Bushmen can do for us. Thank you.
Our speaker this evening has been James Workman, who is the author of the book Heart of Dryness, How the Last Bushman Can Help Us Endure the Coming Age of Permanent Drought. And now we've come to time for the audience Q&A section. So think of your questions. My first question is, could you explain a little bit about the larger Botswana context of why were they shutting off the water, and what was the backstory on that?
Yeah. I want to say, first of all, Botswana has been regarded for a long time as the African success story, and it's deserved that to a large extent by emulating American institutions. It's one of the oldest democracies. It's the most stable. They've never launched a foreign war. But they have also, at the same time, emulated America in ways that we're not necessarily comfortable with, as I alluded to in the opening. There's a prejudice there against indigenous people. They're seen as backwards. They're seen as primitive. The president said, how can you have a Stone Age people living in the time of the computer, and the space age and so forth? If the Bushmen want to survive, they must become like us or they will perish like the dodo. And that's part of it. It's this attitude that they don't really have rights like the rest of us. They're not somehow equal humans. At the same time, they were left alone for an awfully long time. And what was it, as you may be asking, that suddenly triggered this? The government fell all over itself to say it had nothing to do with diamonds, that there was no diamonds that they were worried about. It was purely for developing the Bushmen, to improve their existence. That, over time, came to be false. I spoke with people who had worked for the government and said, this is really a shame. I don't like how we've handled it. very good people. Anyone who's read the detective agency's first lady's first detective agency stories captures some of the mood of the people there. They're middle class. They want to be left alone for the large part. They like shopping. And they're very troubled as the reputation of Botswana has come under attack for what they've done in the Kalahari. But from the government's point of view, it says, well, the mineral wealth underneath the land is ours. We can do what we want with it. The water throughout the Kalahari is ours. We can do what we want with it. The wildlife throughout the country is ours, and we can do what we want with it. Those things make money. Bushmen don't make money. And so they saw it as an expedient step to take of saying, we're just going to move these people off onto a reservation. We'll provide them with schools and all the water they need, and that will make everybody happier. Of course, it turned into the opposite. They were with nothing to do, with no water to gather, with no hunting or gathering to take place. It pretty much eliminated the soul and the function of their human existence there. Alcoholism, AIDS spread, and in some cases the water actually made people sick. It wasn't, you know, purified by the plants. It wasn't something that they had any say over. And so this is the basically diamonds, cattle, and tourism are the three things that Botswana has on its coat of arms. And these are the three things that work to say, okay, let's cut off the bushmen. We've provided them water for 10 years. Now let's take that away, and they'll have to leave. The extraordinary thing in the start of this story is that they didn't. A lot did leave, but a core stayed there, and today more have moved back in.
Jamie, thank you very much for your talk. I wanted to say that it was really interesting because one of the cultural differences I think that you talk about is how there is a history there of sort of the sharing of the commons, that they acknowledge it's a sharing, you know, a common resource that they all can share. And I know even in California that with electricity now, you can generate enough electricity to sell back to PG&E and therefore sort of make it incentivize people to be conservators.
Yep.
But what do you think in terms of, given that cultural backdrop of where we don't have a common way of sharing water, what do you envision in a place like California that we might have some mechanisms of sharing water and make it incentivize people to do that?
Yeah. I've been wrestling with that issue for a while. The thing we need and what we can learn from in terms of, from agricultural rights, when a resource becomes scarce, as water has, it leads to conflict. Conflict, if you say, okay, we're either going to kill each other over this or we're going to find some way to adjudicate rights over this water. That basically happened a century and a half ago in California, giving rise to these water rights between farmers and ranchers and miners. And those persist to this day. What's the lesson to be learned there isn't, you know, that 2% of California's population should control 95% of the water, but that definition of a right is a way of caring more for that water and saying this is something I can negotiate and this keeps me from killing my neighbor. What I would propose and what I'm trying to get across both with some local water districts and elsewhere is saying, well, why can't, you know, 30 million Californians have a right to water as well? Not a right that's protected by the government that says, here you go, but a right that we possess each day, whether it's 50 gallons, 100 gallons, 150 gallons, that we say, this is mine, it's free, and if I don't use that, I'm going to negotiate with somebody for that. It can be operated within the existing utilities, basically opening up markets within monopolies, and it could work the same way for energy. It's a way of combining sort of, as I said, the eBay, the Amazon system that we're all familiar with, and saying, we can find a cheaper, more efficient way, and that would, I think, unleash a race to conserve instead of right now where we look at the water in our toilet or in our sink and just say, well, flush it down. It's not mine. I'm renting it. It's somebody else's. Whereas if we get the bill and say, hey, honey, we got a check this time instead of a bill, and if we use less water, if we start rainwater harvesting, or if we pull up the lawn and plant, you know, xeriscape, as they call it, I guess, the indigenous plants that don't use much water, we can get our check even bigger, a rebate from the people who are using more. And that turns this situation of conflict into cooperation, into collaboration, where instead of, you know, as in Las Vegas or in Atlanta, where this was literally happening, you would call up a hotline and they'd say, psst, you should get the police over here. My neighbor's filling his swimming pool. They're watering their lawn and they're not supposed to be. Where you're narking on your neighbors like that into saying, hey, honey, the neighbor's watering his lawn and filling his pool. This is great. He's going to be buying the water credits that we're not using. So it's trying to get that sense. But right now, we outsource all that. We say, well, it's somebody else's problem. And what the Bushmen taught me is, like, if you can own that water, you don't even necessarily have to gather it. It's coming to our houses as it is. But we would then have an incentive to say, you know, the less I use, the more I benefit. And it harnesses, instead of our altruism to do good in the world, it harnesses our greed, which is something we're all hardwired for, and says, like, so I can make a profit off of not using as much water.
I'm wondering what your position is on the pending legal and legislature controversy over the rights of the farmers versus Northern California in the cities. As I understand it, the farmers consume the lion's share of the water.
Yeah.
And are they underpaying? Are they being denied their fair share? And what's the solution there?
Thank you. I was hoping that would come up. I think about 10 days ago, in an all-night frenzy of 24-hour negotiations and horse trading, the Assembly passed a series of sorry, this is my timer that I'd set to pass a comprehensive water bill. And any of you in this room that's ever pulled an all-nighter, you know, you're up on caffeine and Red Bull and cigarettes and beer or whatever to keep you going. And sometimes if you're with other people, it's this camaraderie of saying, okay, we're going to get this thing done, by gosh. And you wake up the next morning, you give each other high fives, and it's only a few days later you sort of look at what you produced. And I'm afraid that's what's basically happened with this bill. And there was a lot of cheerleaders the moment it came out, people who either wanted to have a stake in it or who had a stake in it, saying, hey, this is great. It's not great. It's a big step back in my mind. And my reasons why is partly to do with the process. It wasn't transparent. A lot of it went through closed doors. There were these, you know, negotiations just at the last minute where I think some special interest said, here's some legislation. It seems something out of, you know, Cheney's approach to energy. There were no fines, really, for water theft, no regulation of groundwater on private land, which is a huge amount, no conservation by agriculture or by the energy, which are the two biggest users. There's billions in pork, and I recognize that that's part of the cost of doing business, and it's also, you know, in the eye of the beholder. But it won't be paid until next year under a bond that comes up, and it goes to some of the very people that were putting the legislation together. The biggest burden, if anyone says there's a great conservation progress, is that it falls hardest on you and I. It says, okay, we're going to get 20% reduction. And it's going to be on these urban areas whose populations are going to be growing. It also goes, I think, in the wrong direction in terms of saying, okay, there's too many people involved with the decision over the Delta. So we're going to take those 300 people who've been negotiating, and we're going to basically put the power in the hands of these seven wise men on the Delta Council. To me, that's a fiercely undemocratic process. They're appointed by the governor. And so they're really not as responsive to you and I. As a typical San Franciscan, I'd love to say, oh, you know, farmers are the ones wasting all the water. They're not. There's a lot of farmers that are doing some very efficient irrigation, especially if they have you know, junior water rights, because they've got to make a little bit of water go a lot further. But I think to say all the burden of conservation is going to fall on urban areas and leaving agriculture out of that burden, I don't think is fair. And this gets at basically the biggest message in the book, and that's that we need to put some more trust, I think, in the wisdom of crowds. I don't think anyone here, myself included, would stand up and say, I'm a water management expert. But I believe that if we all sort of got together in this room and started saying, okay, here's how much water I need, this is how much water is coming in, this is environmental things, and we had a clear, defined amount of water that we could negotiate with one another, we'd come up with a much, much better result. The bill as it is, to me, shows the challenges of the water monopoly and the need to reform it, because right now, too few people are making huge decisions for too many people in a way that's exclusive and undemocratic. I was surprised, actually, at some of the environmental groups that did get on board. I don't see quite why they're ecstatic about it, but I think it may be that they're planning on having a seat at the table about the peripheral canal. And in this regard, I want to take a second here to honor the late Tom Graff of Environmental Defense Fund. He is one of these pioneers in the idea of trading water and finding ways for nonprofits and environmentalists to go to farmers and say, hey, can we lease some of that water at this time of year? Can we put it back in the stream? He's a great man, and his legacy, I think, will endure what he started here in California, because he recognized that unless you put a price on water, whether you're rich or poor, you're going to treat that water as something that's free, and you're going to waste it. And it's only when we value it, when we can own shares of it, and when we have a price signal that we really come to respect it and think in a restorative sense of how much water we can put back in the stream instead of taking out for whether our showers or our farms or something else. But we lost a great man with Tom Graff. Yes. Oops, sorry.
Do you see the extension of water rights to a large portion of the California population or to the entire California population as something that's going to be driven as a grassroots movement, or is it going to be driven from numerous directions?
It's an excellent question. It's sort of, it's great, Jamie, you've got this pie-in-the-sky thing like an author does and says, wow, now you guys go implement it. It reminds me of my days as a speechwriter. But what I'm trying to do in terms of saying where can we get a toehold is start as local as possible. Go to a water district, whether it's an irrigation district, some energy users, commercial users, or ideally some residential water municipalities, and say, okay, how much water are you using? How much do you have? How many meters or individuals are you serving? And start doing some pilots just to see how human behavior changes. Because it's definitely a very subversive idea. It's a very radical idea, this idea of owning water. You're not actually owning the wet stuff itself. You're owning these credits to it. Based on a lot of the economic theory, and again, I'm recognizing my D in economics, the woman who just got the Nobel Prize has been able to show how when you do allocate clear responsibilities and roles and to some degree rights or credits, whatever you want to call it, you don't have that tragedy of the commons that we all fall back on. You have a justice of the commons. You have negotiation over the commons, and you have an efficiency over the commons. But I'm definitely taking sort of, instead of saying, well, the states, the laboratories of democracy, that's true. I would go even further down and say if there's a watershed group of 400 or 500 people on a river, that's one good place to start, where you have the farmers, the residents, the fishermen, all getting a share of that river and saying, okay, this is how much is withdrawn. Let's decide how much we need to take out. And I'm willing to sacrifice some if I can sell you what I don't use. And then going to these utilities, these water districts, these municipalities, and saying, would you like to find a way to reduce water, especially now that you're being mandated to cut your use 20%? Jill.
Hi, Jamie.
Hey, Jill.
So I have a question about getting the everyday person involved in something like this. How, obviously when gas prices went up, people got more green. When they went down, people kind of forgot about it.
Yeah.
especially in a year like this, we're supposed to be in an El Nino year. We're going to get more rain. People then think we have more water. We don't have to worry about conserving.
Yeah.
How do you think the everyday person is going to get on board with something like this and actually want to conserve or think that, you know, a check that they get would be worth it to actually conserve? I think that's kind of an ongoing problem that we're going to see with this, because people, even in a drought, they still get the water.
Yeah.
So how do you think you can work through that or get people on board?
I think in a drought you get the water, but that water you get becomes more valuable. The same as when an OPEC puts the squeeze on, or when there's trouble in the Middle East with oil, that the prices do go up. We have a lot of options and choices at our disposal with oil. We can, it'll sound crazy or naive, but we can say, I'll ride a bike, our carpool. I'll take the Muni into town. I will work from home. You have all those options. Now, maybe what you're getting at is that with water, you need a certain amount, obviously, to survive, to stay clean and to cook. But how you get that water is another matter. You can recycle it. The technology is there. You can capture it in rainwater harvesting. You can purify it. You can find different ways of gathering and using and recycling it, as the Bushmen do. But with more technology than they could even imagine. This is the part that I'm still starting to learn about, is how much, you know, you can't actually decentralize water in the same way that we can decentralize energy use. And again, this water is the same amount that's always there. But if we captured water, a certain amount of water, a year ago, you could keep using that water and purifying it. And some places do that again and again and again. And some firms here in Silicon Valley are starting to do that because they need water at such a high quality. But the main point is to say, okay, this is now mine. This is my share. And, you know, just like a share in real estate before it went down, people respond to those signals. And I believe they will. I could very well be wrong, but that's why I'm trying to say let's do some pilots that see how human behavior changes. Instead of fighting the water utility, the monopoly, saying, hey, you're raising your rates too high, we may very well start seeing people say, hey, I've saved all this water, these credits, basically like frequent flyer miles or credit card loyalty points. I want them to be worth more. And so the one way to make them worth more, Mr. Monopoly, is if you raise your rates, because then I'll be able to trade this for even more than it's worth right now. I don't know if that got at what you're asking, Jill, but I do believe that since we respond to the price of milk, since we respond to the price of oil, and make decisions on our own voluntarily as a response, I think we can start doing the same thing with water.
Yes, I was curious about, I'm just correlating the relationship between water and, let's say, energy from windmills. In Denmark, I remember reading and seeing some documentaries on a community-based village that invested in energy from building windmills and harvesting the energy and then using it for their proper usage and then selling the rest back yeah. into the power companies. Yeah. And I was curious to know whether, I know in Canada there is a couple of communities that are doing that with water. I've heard of that. But I was curious, do you know of anything happening like that in America where a community is actually private, community-funded water companies that they buy like stocks and they are actually invested, like you were talking about, in owning it? And for me, it would seem, well, let me stop there and ask you if that's something that you know about.
To my knowledge, the investments, if you want to say, I want to make a killing off of the water scarcity problem, and that's a fair assessment for people to make. They invest in companies that are managing water at a, you know, RWE, Thames, Veolia, Suez. those big, huge companies that are involved in managing water, will you invest in some of the technology, desalination technology? To my knowledge, there's no water being sold and bought itself on the open market, except, ironically, in the black market of the third world. You go to India, you go to Africa, in the slums and in the urban areas and in rural areas, you'll see these guys constantly driving around in trucks, taking off their water to the, usually the women are buying it, and it's totally unregulated, and it's extremely efficient. When people are buying water in these areas, they really look after it. They make it go a long way, and they make sure it's boiled and so forth. My only problem with that is that, and it's a big one, is that the people in the cities are paying maybe, you know, 0.1% for the same amount of water of their income, whereas in the poor slums, they're having to pay 30-40% of their income for that same amount of water, and it's probably of a worse quality, and it leads to situations of women trading their you know, sex for that water. But it does get towards the efficiency, and my ideal would be like if you can take that black market and legitimize it. Say these people who are out there, they get a certain credit that is, you know, guaranteed by the government, and that will bring people to improve the quality and the service to those areas. In India, again, this is happening in tanker trucks. It's not charity when it's done between, you know, people in these areas. It's only when sort of an NGO comes in and says, here's some water for you to relieve your thirst and building a water pump or a well.
First of all, congratulations on the book. I thought it was terrific.
Yes, right.
to the extent that it kept me up and annoyed me tremendously to see how these poor people were being treated. But one of the things you talked about in the book was just the inability of them either to get their rights to water,
yeah,
or to be able to buy on the free market.
Yeah.
And you've talked a lot about individuals' rights to water, but I guess to what extent do you think that can be solved with just a free market pricing mechanism? Because the rights, presumably, also is what farmers have,
sure,
in California, rather than just saying we're going to raise the price.
Right. There's restrictions on the farmers, I believe, in terms of both social pressures on them and legal restrictions on whether they can or how much they can sell or lease. I'm not a libertarian. I'm not a get the government out. I believe very strongly in science, in measurements, in oversight. But I believe a lot of that is in place. What I'm wish, you know, if I say, okay, I play God, what's going to happen in the Kalahari, is that every person, rich or poor, bushman or otherwise, in Botswana has a share of the water, and then they can negotiate with De Beers, they can negotiate with the cattle barons, they can negotiate with the tourism areas and say, fine, if you want to use some of my water, then let's talk about this, let's negotiate that. You're from South Africa. I think there's another person here from South Africa. It was an extraordinary thing I remember following, where when the new government of Mandela came in, they said, look, all this water that's been going to the under apartheid, that's been going to the whites, this is now part of the state. We can decide who it goes to. The farmers were still, you know, operating, but in one area, a white fifth generation African says, we'd like to take some of this surplus water from this river, and the government says, I'm sorry, you're white. This is for previously disadvantaged, and they said. And so the guy thought, and he said, okay. Well, he rounded up 50 of his farm workers and said, look, I can't get this water, you guys can. And so they said, oh, so this is ours. Okay, so this is the government will give us water but not you, and this may get to your question as well. So they formed a partnership between this farmer and his former workers. They brought the water to the table, he brought the management expertise, and another guy brought the engineering to it. I'm on record as being a pretty big skeptic of dams. This was an area where they pumped the water out of the river to store in the dam. That was the most efficiently run farm I've ever seen, and it was so because these guys knew that every drop of water that was wasted eroded their share of the water, and it brought equity that they could negotiate with their former boss as partners, and it, it it unleashed this whole new way of looking at the water. The interesting thing was they started to really start worrying like the farmer. Before, they were just like, oh, well, you know, water doesn't rain. That's his problem. I'm going to get my salary. And they started saying, I just don't know if it's going to rain. You know, if we can't, what's going to happen? And I told him about this. He's like, they're starting to think like farmers. And that's the big goal, not just to think like farmers, but to think like bushmen, to think like, you know, 21st century bushmen, where we start looking ahead and saying, you know, climate change is looking pretty bad here. And instead of saying, well, that's some manager's problem, we start thinking, that's my problem. And how am I going to start preparing for that? Am I going to do rainwater harvesting? Am I going to find ways to use less? Am I going to switch my big flush toilet to a composting toilet? All these little decisions, I think, add up very quickly to a lot more autonomy and, at the same time, sustainability.
I also would like to thank you for the book, which was compelling and wonderful, and I couldn't put it down. One of the things I was so struck by was the level of water literacy that all of the Bushmen children had from birth, really. I mean, they just simply grew up with this integrated into their education, yeah. Right, and their awareness of the world. So I'm curious about your opinion on water literacy in the school systems. And how our children are being taught about water. I know you have two daughters. I have five kids.
Oh, my gosh.
And they're older, I think. But one of the things I was so shocked by is when they went through school, they learned basics about the hydraulic cycle and a little bit about watersheds, and now there are really wonderful groups, you know, trying to teach about watersheds, but they're mostly teaching to younger kids, I think. And I'm wondering if you had one, two, or possibly three points on water literacy that you could see integrated into the curriculum or offered to students and teachers completely for free, yeah. Perhaps over the internet.
Yeah.
What would those points be?
That's a great question. What I'd propose, first of all, is I'd love to come talk to students about this in ways that they can spread that that literacy. I think it's important. I've started to see some books that are addressing this in visual ways and at different levels. It's sort of like, you know, an ethic doesn't emerge overnight, as Aldo Leopold has pointed out. It's something that's both passed on and then thrown back at us at times, where, you know, the danger of teaching our children to say, oh, you know, don't leave the sink on while you're brushing your teeth, is you can be sure that, you know, 2 days later they're going to yell at you for doing the same thing. And that's the way it should be. It becomes self-reinforcing. I think the best, you know, water literacy is by example, and that's how Oraklu and the others passed on their wisdom through stories and through examples. I do think both the water literacy of each new generation keeps improving. Unfortunately, we also at the same time in our regular lives get further and further and further from the source. I'd mentioned Aldo Leopold before. He'd said something, I'll paraphrase it, that one of the dangers of not owning a farm, as he had, is that you believe that your food comes from the grocery store and that your heat comes from the furnace. And I think we're at the same stage with water, that we grow up thinking the water comes from that hole in the wall. But as you said, people are starting to say, okay, you're part of this system here. I think I was 14 before I recognized that, you know, I was showering in Hetch Hetchy water. And that was a big failing on my part. But once you do make that connection, as they have, then it really drives it home. So I that's probably three or four points or not at all. But I think we're headed in the right direction, and I'd love to talk to you afterwards about how, you know, how we can spread this message.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that you're listening to James Workman, author of the new book, Heart of Dryness, How the Last Bushman Can Help Us Endure the Coming Age of Permanent Drought. And now we're coming to the point in our program where we have time for just one last question. Oh, good, I get to ask it. Oh, no, here we go.
If you were made water czar in a week's time or something, what would a national plan regarding water look like?
Basically, I think the power of the czar or the president is a bully pulpit, as Teddy Roosevelt used so effectively. Rather than passing a law, there's a big debate now about is there a human right to water? And I get into that in the book. It's a universal thing. It was put up in California, and it was vetoed. This, I think, is the essence of it. If you say we need a human right to water, is it the kind of thing you can just hand down from being a czar and saying, now you have a right to water, enjoy it? Or is it something, then, if you can do that, then you can say, I'm taking that back, as Botswana did with the Bushmen. Say, by the way, actually, no, I've changed my mind, you can't. So I would try, as from the bully pulpit, to stir things up, say, hey, you know, you guys should be demanding of your utility, of your water district, of your state, of your, you know, city, that human right to water. And I think you should make it a right that is defined, that is defended by you and through the law, and that can be divested, that you can trade. Because unless you can trade it, that right to water is pretty worthless. So those would be my three, you know, main points that I think I'd be hammering around as waters are. It would be a pretty hypocritical position for me to say, you know, I want this position after saying how undemocratic our system is when it comes to water as it is. But using the bully pulpit in that fashion, I think, is appropriate and would lead the most durable results.
Please join me in thanking our speaker, James Workman.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker has been James Workman, author of the new book, Heart of Dryness, How the Last Bushman Can Help Us Endure the Coming Age of Permanent Drought. I am Kerry Curtis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, observing over a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.